I'm here with Michael Rutleff. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the invitation. I'm excited.
Yeah, we're on Zoom, and we were planning to talk on the conference in Denmark, Sports Congress, but unfortunately, like everything else, it got cancelled.
That was quite the shame, both in terms of getting out and about and discussing all types of research with clinicians and researchers, but also the opportunity to actually meet you again in person and do it face to face. But I think this is the second best option.
Yeah, we had a really nice lunch at the Norwegian Sports Congress this autumn, and I have to say I'm really, really pleased that you said yes to participating in this conversation. So thank you very much. And we're going to talk about one of your favorite subjects, I assume, patellofemoral pain, mostly in adolescents, but maybe we'll touch on grown-ups as well. It would be nice if you could start up with giving us a short tour of your academic career to know your background.
Yeah, so originally I'm trained as a physiotherapist from Aarhus in Denmark, and then I did a master's degree in what we call sort of health science. And then I undertook a PhD at Aarhus University in a collaboration with Aalborg, where I am now. It was a four-year PhD because I did it sort of combined with my master's, a funny odd version we have here in Denmark. But that was all focused on patellofemoral pain and knee pain in general in kids. So that got me or at least allowed me to focus quite specifically on adolescent knee pain, adolescent patellofemoral pain during the years of my PhD. And then, you know, when you do a PhD, it's sort of, you're left with more questions than answers. And you're also left with the feeling of, you think you can solve all world problems during a PhD because you're undertaking a massive PhD, 3 or 4 years. And then afterwards, you find out how little work you can actually do during such an extended period of time, despite you're working super hard. So it left some questions related to sort of the underlying pathology of patellofemoral pain. Also, some questions relating to how important is exercises at all. Maybe we should be focusing more on sort of the education and helping them modify their activity levels. So that's what I spent my postdoctoral studies on, trying to get more into both understanding it from their perspective, but also trying to tinker around with sort of a management strategy that was more focused on empowering them to self-manage their knee pain, where exercises were also a part of it, but just as much teaching them how to modify how much they do and also help them get back to how much they would like to do. And then afterwards, I slowly progressed into becoming a research group leader. And now I'm head of a group here at Aalborg University, which is called Musculoskeletal Health and Implementation, where I'm in a shared professorship between Center for General Practice, where we focus on musculoskeletal complaints in general practice here in Denmark. And the other leg of my education or employment is at Department of Health Science and Technology at Aalborg University, where our master's program in musculoskeletal physiotherapy is anchored. So I'm also quite heavily involved in teaching the next generation of musculoskeletal physiotherapists. And we do a lot of research in musculoskeletal health throughout the lifespan. So that means we don't only focus on adolescents with knee pain, but we still have quite a substantial part of our group that shares the same interest as I do, and also see there's a lot of opportunities to move this field forward, especially now where we've started to work more closely with psychologists and sociologists in terms of improving the management of adolescent knee pain, which has really opened my eyes when you step out of our traditional sort of ways at looking at the elephant, where you get people that look at it from a completely different angle, which is super interesting.
Yeah, the interdisciplinarity is really nice. But I found it a bit funny because when I contacted you the first time, which was maybe a year ago or something, I asked if you can send me your PhD, your thesis, because I couldn't find the whole thesis online. And I like to like read the intro section and the theory section, because then you often get an overview from someone who's really into the subject. But your answer was, maybe you should just look up the articles, because it's outdated. The rest is outdated. So that says something about how the field is evolving, maybe. What do you think?
I think it's a delicate question, because I don't know who's listening to this, but I think that PhD thesis was written on the way back from Australia, where I had the opportunity to spend 3 or 4 months together with Bill Vicencino. And then sort of the PhD thesis kind of got left in the background for quite a bit of time. So my thesis was a very quick 7 or 10 day work streak, where the majority of the writing was done on my way back from Australia and back to Denmark just before my wife gave birth to our first one. So that was, I think it was my way of saying, maybe you shouldn't spend too much time looking at my thesis, because it's not the strongest thesis, to be honest.
That's an honest answer. Yeah, I was a bit surprised that you said don't read my work. But let's dive into the patellofemoral pain subject. Maybe we should just mention how large is this problem. I read like in adolescence it's about 6 or 7% the prevalence. Is that correct? What about the grown-up or the general population?
It's actually true that we've done a couple of studies where we've gone out into school-based populations. We've actually done 2 population-based studies where we look at all the kids in specific school within specific age ranges, either from 15 to 19, or also from, I think it was 15 to 18. And when you reach the age of around 14 or 15, the prevalence in schools, at least here in Denmark, is between 6 and 7%. So both these studies actually found just around 6 to 7%. So one in every 14, I think there's a study from the States as well that showed sort of a similar prevalence. But then when you go into really sports active adolescents, you of course see a prevalence that is even higher than these 6 or 7 percent. So in adolescents, very, very common. When you go into to the adult population, for example, it's very, very mixed, because a lot of the studies look at either military recruits, where you have a famous study from Michelle Bowling, I think it was in naval recruits, where they saw how many that entered basic training. They were naval recruits. And I think it was around 2 or 2.5% that developed patellofemoral pain during their basic military training. But then you have a really nice study from I think it was a Belgian group, Van Tickelen and his colleagues. Sorry if I'm not pronouncing it correctly. But they looked at military infantry that went into basic military training. So these were between, I think, 18 and 24 or something, quite young individuals. And there within 6 weeks, I think it was 42 or 43% developed an acute onset of patellofemoral pain. They didn't have patellofemoral pain before, but to me, this all ties into something about if you change how much you do, that seems to be at least a potential risk factor for the onset of patellofemoral pain. So your question about how common is it in the general population? We don't have a lot of good studies in very generalizable population, but my guess is that it's similar to, if not higher, compared to what we see in the adolescents.
Yeah, but when we look at the prevalence numbers, it sort of gives a headline of what kind of problem this is, because like military recruits, they always have trouble when you study them. But the sporting population, there's some kind of a headline that's made when looking at the prevalence numbers. And also, as we know, the incidence is less, so it's more of an overuse, gradual onset problem.
Yeah, and once you got it, it seems to sort of stick with you for a long, long time, and you're very likely to to get it again if you've had it for, yeah, if you had it once. But maybe we can get back to that in the we discussed the prognosis part of this very common condition.
Yeah, but when I'm in the clinic and I'm going to give, if I'm going to find out if this is patellofemoral pain, what kind of diagnosis is this?
Yeah, that's a good question. I can feel I'm almost anxious to give an answer to this because it's one of the areas where there's so much uncertainty. What is it really? Because today, the way we diagnose it, it's more diagnosis by exclusion. So when we've ruled out all the more structure-specific conditions, sending Larsen Johansson, Osgood Slatter, or something in the kits, then when we're left with kids that have pain when they load on a flexed knee, sort of diffuse anterior knee pain, then we call it patellofemoral pain. But to be honest, we don't have a really good understanding of what's actually going on, what's the pathology of patellofemoral pain. And I think that's part of the tricky aspect here, because we have unspecific low back pain, but just in the knee. And when we, as both clinicians and researchers, are uncertain about what it is, then it also becomes even more challenging to talk to the patient about what this is. How can we give them a credible explanation, a good sound explanation of what it is, if we don't really know ourselves? And then we have to find alternative ways of explaining this diffuse pain on the anterior part of your kneecap.
I wanted to discuss this challenge with a diagnosis of exclusion, because that's a troubling diagnosis. If you tear your ACL, you say you have teared your ACL and they have a name for it. They know the mechanism. They know what happened. And diagnosing people by exclusion, it's hard. And I've been working with like functional neurological disorders. And functional is just another name for we don't know anything about what it is. So we call it functional. We don't have an MRI, but we can see that you have a huge amounts of pain and can't walk. But then I listened to this lecture by a professor called John Stone, I think. And he was saying that we should stop using this exclusion part. We should describe more of the positive symptoms. What do you see? What do you have? What are the positive symptoms? Because people want to know what they have and not what they don't have.
Yeah,
and that could be somewhat comparable to this kind of diagnosis. And to non-specific, you know, low back pain. And do you understand what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I understand what you're getting at. Maybe some of the new stuff we've been looking into can sort of like feed into this discussion, because I don't think there's a clear-cut answer and we're not going to get to the bottom of this during this podcast. But what we can see in some of the research we're doing right now is that So some of the stuff we have just published by Simon Johansson, the pain stories, it was published in Journal of Pain, sort of looked at the trajectory towards competency of self-management in kids with or young adults who's been suffering from long-standing knee pain ever since adolescence. And one of his findings was that in these early phases where you have uncertainty about what is it? Why do I have pain? You start to become aware of it. It pops up to your consciousness. And one of the things that progress you into being able to take more care of what it is that you sort of get a name for your knee pain. That led us to believe that the diagnosis of knee pain, a specific diagnosis, was important, because some of his data suggests that when they have a specific diagnosis, a name for their knee pain, they start to be able to communicate with teachers and parents and their coaches about why I can't play full on, why I have to sit out and so on. But we've been trying to sort of dig to the bottom of this, and it doesn't appear that it's the actual name that is essential. The name doesn't really matter if I put it on, if I try to carve it out. It's the explanation behind it that is important, because as some of these young kids explain, when they get a credible explanation for why they have knee pain, it functions as reassurance of that it's not dangerous, it's something they can manage. It gives them a way forward. And at least in if I look back at what I have been interested in, which has been exercises and all sorts of things, this important aspect of what we do initially, early on when we see them in the clinic, try to both give them a name, but also a credible explanation for why they have pain, seems to be much more important than I've ever sort of realized, because I always wanted to go, now we need to do an exercise, a hip exercise, we need to work on your hip extensors and so on. And I've sort of neglected these, what appears based on our qualitative research to be so important for everything that happens afterwards, that we do these initial things really, really well. And one of the initial things is good communication in terms of giving a name, and the specific name is not important for them, but a credible explanation for why they have knee pain, because that removes all the uncertainty. It becomes reassuring for them as they explain it to us.
I think that's the article by Johansson is really great, and I would say that people should download and read it. Thank you for sending it to me. And it's like you said, if I read from the article, it says like getting a name made the condition communicable to others and aided them and others to accept their condition. So it's the acceptance phase in this trajectory that was really nice to they really carve it out, the importance of how they're able to communicate to others and feel validated, and the people that didn't get a name and didn't get an explanation, they felt in the opposite direction. They feel exactly unvalidated and had trouble communicating it. But I have to be honest, I've been having patients, adolescents with patellofemoral pain, and I tried for myself how to communicate this. And I've said, like, I'm not sure, it's hard to say specifically why you have this pain. And when reading this article, I get a bit embarrassed, but that's how we learn as a clinician, of course. You have to trial and error. So the communication part, I found this part really hard, saying what it is. And I try to be like more honest about my insecurity, but then, and you can see it in their faces. You can see they don't like the answer. So then I challenge myself sometimes to be a bit more clear and just say, be a bit more direct. And you can see that their faces light up a bit more and their parents are nodding behind them. And it's quite obvious when you see it in the clinic, the different kind of explanation tactics.
Completely agree. But I think this, now we're touching on another thing that's really interesting, is this, there's a certain trend in medicine these days that we also have to embrace uncertainty and also communicate it to the patient. So we make a joint decision on what's the road forward. But I think my experience from dealing with adolescents and also parents and so on, it's really, really hard for them. If you sit with a 12-year-old boy, especially the boys, like trying to communicate uncertainty to them, I don't think it works super, super well with these young ones. As far as I understand why it's important, because we are not certain about what it is. But I would, as you also say here, try and be as specific, even though we know, well, the explanation I'm giving might not be 100% scientifically correct. Maybe I can't vouch for all the details in this explanation, but you're trying to accomplish something with your explanation. You're trying to reassure them. You're trying to get them to accept the situation. So the explanation becomes sort of like a means to something good for them. So we have good intentions when we try to describe it to them, despite we know that it's not 100% correct. So I'm with you. That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, I agree. But and they're uncertain about everything else in their life. So maybe we should add on to their disease as well. Uncertain about it. If you can try to be a bit more specific, how would you say, what kind of words would you prefer we use, and what would you say? How would you explain a PFP diagnosis?
So maybe as for the show notes, we can try and link to one of the slides I used for the workshop you were referring back to, because that is something we're working on right now, trying to develop what we call credible diagnoses for kids. So sort of getting their input on, is this explanation actually acceptable and credible to you? And then we're trying to make some cue sheets for clinicians to use afterwards, because I also find it to be challenging. But more specifically, what I would try and do is when you go through your subjective, the history taking, I would try to use as much as I could from the history taking to sort of give them an explanation for why it could be that you actually develop this type of knee pain. And I would absolutely not go into saying you have weak knees or you have something within you that caused the onset of this pain, trying to get them to understand how it could be a mix between both how much they did. Typically, it's something related to how much they do. At least that's my experience, because the kids we've seen is often very sports active. But then they say to you, well, I'm not doing anything differently compared to what I normally do. Then I would try to look into, well, how are you with friends these days, or how are you with sleep? Trying to move out their sort of like perspective of why can you actually get pain and what influence my pain. So I try to use something from the history taking to provide an explanation for why potentially they could have developed pain. And then, of course, there's a language barrier here, but I would say something related to, so you have what is called patellofemoral pain, and I would use patellofemoral pain because some of the kids also like that it has a specific name. I wouldn't just call it knee pain because they already know that they have knee pain. They come to me.
That's a challenge I had. I felt like anterior knee pain is too it's not advanced enough. They need a more special name for it, and that feels better.
I had a provocative, I think he was 14 or 15, who said, when I used the term like anterior knee pain, forced a knismatter in Danish, he was like, yeah, that's why I'm here seeing you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. Do I need to pay for this?
Exactly. So in trying to give them a credible explanation, I would say that so patellofemoral pain is a combination of different factors where you have sort of like tissues in your kneecap that become sensitized. So it can become sensitized from either you're doing too much or you're taking too little time off. But the interesting thing, like from what we've learned during the last few years, is that what we feel like pain is also influenced by how much we sleep, how happy we are, how we're doing with friends or parents and so on. And often they seem to buy in on this, that they know that sometimes when I'm cold, when I'm angry or when I'm sad, hurting my finger often hurts a lot more compared to a day where I'm actually quite happy. And because if they don't sort of like get this combination between how they feel and also their knee pain, I try to ask them, how do you feel it? How do you think it feels to hit your finger on a day you're sad compared to where you're happy? And then often they sort of like play along and say, well, okay, I understand that the pain is also influenced by a lot more than just the type of sport that you do.
I try to use different, sometimes when they're kids, like if they play football, I would like to use an example of like Cristiano Ronaldo. When I say like, do you think he feels different when his ankle twists the day before the Champions League final or some other day, just off season? It makes a huge difference what kind of day it is, in what context, and that's how it is for everyone. So I try to use the sort of like the stars. They also feel different about to give them.
That's actually a very, very good. That's a very, very good suggestion. I think for some kids that would work much, much better than the suggestion that I proposed here.
I have heard several metaphors of sensitization, but like this metaphor with when you hurt your finger on a paper or something, like a paper cut, and then you say if you push on where you got the paper cut, it's sore, but it doesn't make you more injured. Your paper cut doesn't get larger.
Yeah.
And then I say like that's how it is inside your knee. Like if you it's sensitized and it's it tries to protect your knee. It's your body trying to protect your knee. But if you use it, it doesn't make you more injured necessarily. And then it might be a bit more complex, but
I think I think all the clinicians listening here, they know the patient standing in front of them. And there you have to sort of like find a credible explanation that fits with their context. If they're a football player, do as you say, like tie it into football. If they're into something else, make it relevant to them. It's the same when what you mentioned here about the paper cut. I'm still struggling about how to do these metaphors, because what I've seen earlier is that when I use these paper cut or the bruise metaphors, some of them perceive that there's something like wrong in their knee, that there's sort of like tissue damage within their knee. And I'm trying to at least not go into that direction. If we don't have evidence that there's specific tissue involvement, then it's not likely patellofemoral pain anymore.
Yeah, that's really nice, because that's like, as a clinician, you would often like, you can see they like the tissue explanation because it often makes sense. It's the Cartesian way of thinking. It's how they think pain is, and then it makes me feel good because I can use the metaphor and they sort of buy into it. But on the other hand, I give them a sort of more a tissue based direction, which, as you say, it might not be the optimal way of going forward.
I think it's a question to be explored. At least this is something we're trying to explore now in the studies, on a credible explanation to also, like, because sometimes I also feel like, well, are you just jumping on this bandwagon of everybody being afraid of trying to use tissue-based explanations, or does it make sense to the kids? And I'm at a stage now where I think, well, we just need to ask the kids, basically, because they have the answer to it. But the reason why I'm careful not to do it is that in one of our previous studies, we actually saw that around 50 or 55% of the kids, they were sort of like afraid of pain, because they thought that when they felt pain, something inside their knee becomes damaged. So they have, even between the age of 10 and 14, they make this association between pain and also something is being damaged to my knee. And a lot of them, they used, I'm trying to avoid pain because I'm afraid of damaging my knee. And that then becomes a driver for them to be less physically active. Which I think is another point when we're supporting these young kids with knee pain, that we have to try and find ways to make them stay active and not reducing their physical activity levels. Because we can see in our prospective studies that some of these young kids, they drop out of their sport simply due to pain. They're also afraid of damaging their knee because they have pain.
What I really found interesting and enjoyed reading the pain stories article by Johansson is one sentence that says, like, clinicians should facilitate own inquiry that they accept it with the diagnosis, and then they have to start learning and relearning as part of this process. And this initial communication part is sort of the support, and we're not going to like give them all the answers, because this is maybe going to last for a while. I really like that part of the article, just like, okay, as a clinician, calm down, just try to facilitate some kind of self-inquiry with learning and relearning.
Exactly. Simon, who's the first author, is a PhD student in my group. He's a super clever guy. He actually have a background in information science, so he's not a healthcare practitioner, but he's just come in and seen this field that we're looking into now with a completely different set of goggles. One of the things he's also keen on is that he often says that our self-management of any type of condition only becomes as good as the challenges we encounter.
Yeah.
I really like that as well, especially when we sit with patients, that it's about giving them certain challenges. And hey, if we fail, it's a super good opportunity for learning and reflecting. And what will you do next time you experience this challenge or barrier for accomplishing X, Y, or Z?
That might be a nice segue into the rehab part of patellofemoral pain, but I want to start that segment with quoting you, because you held a talk at the sports science conference, I think, science of fitness conference in 2017. It's on YouTube, It's a lecture you hold, and in the lecture you say, I think exercise therapy has very, very little to offer compared to education. And I, and I smiled when you said that, because that sort of pulls apart most of what I think we do as physiotherapists, being exercise-based myself and thinking that exercise is key to most rehab.
So I think at that stage, I was in the post-processing of the poor results from what was my main study in my PhD, where we compared patient education to patient education and exercise therapy. A really well done program. We offered it at school. We offered it group-based, individualized. It was actually quite nice. And then when we looked at the outcomes in the following 2 years in these 121 kids that are randomized to either patient education or patient education combined with exercise therapy, we saw that the net result of the benefit of adding on exercise therapy was really, really small. So I think at that conference, I was thinking back to how little it actually had to offer at least these 15 to 19 year old adolescents. But that program, if I look back to it, was very much how I perceived the world back then. I thought it was all about finding the right exercise that needed to be motivating, it needed to be challenging. We needed to have it at an adequate load. I thought 10 to 12 repetition maximum, because my gut feeling was that a lot of the previous exercise therapy has been too little resistance, too little focus on improving strength and improving control during functional movements and so on. So even though we tried to make what I think was a nice program, it didn't really have the benefit that that I hoped it would have. The reason why it was so interesting for me back then was that the national guideline for managing kids with patellofemoral pain back then just said, give them rest, send them back home and say everything would be okay. And I thought, hey, we're missing out on a huge opportunity to improve these young people's lives. We just need to add on exercise therapy to the advice. But then it didn't really have the effect that I hoped it would. And what we saw in that trial us was that a lot of the kids didn't adhere to the education side of things. We said they should reduce their activity and slowly build back up again. And we could see that they just kept on pushing. And then when you sort of think about it, we wanted them to reduce their physical activity levels because they were doing like 3-4 times sports per week in addition to school-based physical activity. And then we added on 2 or 3 times of exercise therapy every week again. And how in the world do we think that's going to have a positive effect if they're already doing maybe too much, having long severe knee pain, then we're just adding on more exercise on top of that? How in the world do we think, like in hindsight, that would actually work? And we could see those that didn't adhere and just kept on with the high physical activity levels were very, very unlikely to actually recover. So one of the strongest prognostic factors was that if you didn't reduce your physical activity levels in the initial phase, then you were not going to recover at all. So that led us into the next study, which I also addressed at the German conference, where we tried to develop a new strategy based on user experiences, where we sort of tried to put it all together. So not neglecting the exercise, but adding in a stronger component of self-management and education on how you can sort of like lower your physical activity levels and then giving you the tools to slowly progress based on some predefined criteria that we developed, sort of like an activity ladder and a pain monitoring tool that was based on Roland Thomé's phenomenal old work back from the 90s. And I think that's a sensible approach, especially the whole aspect about modifying how much they do and then giving them the tools on how they can slowly progress back up again.
Now we're back at the pain stories articles, like self-inquiry, giving them, instead of saying, I'm going to give you some exercise. And then you say like, here are some information and tools and I'll try to teach them. And then you can have your trajectory, your self-inquiry.
Exactly.
Because either way, if they will probably have their own trajectory, you will just add on some exercise, like you say. But it's not self-management in the same way.
But I do think...
But could I ask you one question? Because just before we dive too much into the exercise space, could I ask maybe a challenging question? Do they need rehab? Should we give them rehab, or should we just back off and stay? Would it make a difference? Do we know this?
So if we look broadly into the literature, we don't have a lot of evidence to support an active approach compared to a wait and see. We have very, very shallow ground in terms of research there. We have Marinus Winters, who did a network meta-analysis to look at the evidence base for managing patellofemoral pain in not just in adolescents, but also in adults. And we can see that the whole aspect of waiting and seeing, we don't have a lot of strong RCTs with a true wait and see or natural history component to it. Sometimes I wonder how much added benefit there really is in what we have to offer in terms of purely exercise. But what I also think when you say that is that we sometimes become super reductionistic. We talk of a patient with patellofemoral pain, and I'm sure that when you think of a patient with patellofemoral pain, you could think of Martin, who's a 12-year-old who came to you 2 weeks after the first onset because he was a football player. And he's just gone through a soccer camp where they played nonstop for 7 days and didn't really sleep because they also had so much fun during it. And he's developed an onset of knee pain. For him, I don't think that exercises is an important component early on to help him. But if I think back to some of the slightly older teenagers, 17 or 18, who's had a period of on-off knee pain, 3, 4, 5 years, they've dropped out of their sport because the knee pain kept bothering them. They've become sort of like deconditioned. If they want to, or if their goal is to get back into sport, I think rehab, the exercise part, would be an important segue for helping them get back into sport and become conditioned to take up soccer or whatever sport they would like to get back into. So my point here is just that I think for some, I don't think exercises are important, but for others, I think exercises is part of how I think we can help these young individuals, because this group of patients is so heterogeneous. There's so many different stories and symptom durations that I think it's hard to answer your question if it's rehab.
Now we're into like what's evidence-based practice. So not having the RCTs isn't necessarily an answer to why we shouldn't do exercise.
And yeah, it's also because when we talk about exercise, we have to ask ourselves, why am I thinking of an exercise? Is it that I'm prescribing an exercise because I think that improving their maximal strength or their strength endurance or something is important? I think for this population, we don't have any evidence to suggest that improving their maximal strength is associated with higher rates of recovery. But I do think we have quite a couple of studies coming out in the next year or two that suggest that improving muscle strength is not associated with improvements in function or pain. Like the study we did together with Bill Vicencino, Mark Matthews, and Sinead Holden in JOSPT, where we did a mediation analysis showing that hip strength is, or improvement in hip strength is not important for patients' recovery. But I think if we think of now going back to pain stories and some of the things you mentioned early on, if I prescribe an exercise to Martin, who's 14, he thinks he has patellofemoral pain because he has weak knees. He has a low confidence that his knees can actually do anything. If I would do an exercise there with a blue TheraBand and use it to improve his self-efficacy or try to challenge some of the functional beliefs he has about why he has knee pain, then I think exercise can be a powerful tool for challenging his beliefs. Can use an exercise and not use it for the improvement in strength, but to use it to communicate a message and say, wow, your knees strong? Can you see how the muscles are working? Try to frame it in a positive environment about all the things that he can do and not the things he can't do. And if that is the benefit of an exercise, then I think we just need to be aware of it, that exercise can have many different purposes. We just need to use it with care for what we want to accomplish with the exercise. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure. And it's just more complex as a clinician to with the aim of your exercise is not what we normally would think, like getting stronger and sort of addressing what we would assume are the risk factors. And then, as you say now, strength is deficit is not a good risk factor. So that also challenges our assumptions of why we should prescribe exercise. But I think if we can get there, like giving exercise based on contextual effects, that would be great. But that's, again, you have to sort of own your own insecurity and why this should help. And I remember when we discussed, you and I discussed this at the workshop you held, again, the communication part being specific and sort of giving a buy-in for the exercise, why they should do this, then it's more easy to say you should do this and you will get stronger and then you will get better and they will believe you and then they will get stronger because exercise mostly makes you stronger. And if they get better, that's sort of, that's a nice trajectory that you would be a bit more clear in your communication and buy-in, and maybe it makes them do their exercise instead of not doing it. And that's also the adherence part.
Yeah.
So there's many aspects in how we communicate. Like, why should I say to Martin that he should do hip exercises? Why? Because I give hip exercises to several of my patients, and I also test their hips, and they can feel that they're not too strong. And yeah, then maybe I make them feel weak. I don't know. I'm not sure.
But I don't. If you think that the patient in front of you would like buy in if you prove or test that they have strength deficits on the side where they have pain, and you think that improving their maximal strength because Martin wants to go back into soccer and you know there's huge demand during side cutting and so on for his hip strength, then I think it's perfect to use measurement of the strength to get the buy-in, to get him to really focus on the exercises afterwards, as long as you know that the intended purpose is to improve his hip strength and not necessarily that's going to cure his knee pain, as an example. So I think that it's not a bad idea to use the tools you have to create the change that you think is needed for the individual in front of you. And it's just important to be like sort of skeptic towards the research, because everything becomes so simplistic in research. But when we stand in the clinic, there's so many different stories that these young individuals or their parents bring into the consultation room. And sometimes I think super good idea with measuring hip strength, and other times it's just about giving them a positive experience with their knee, proving they can do something. And then maybe later on, it's about measuring their hip strength and progressing from there. But we just need to know where to start to get the buy-in from these adolescents. Because one of the other studies we're doing now with the sociologist and psychologist in terms of supporting kids with non-traumatic knee pain is that these kids, when they have to reflect on like a good experience with a clinician, the whole communication becomes one of the most pivotal things they mention, that they feel they're heard, that the clinician speaks to them in a way they can understand, that they're being told why they need to do certain things. That becomes key. And all the things that are shining from this study they've done, a qualitative study on the user experiences of rehabilitation, is that communication is by far one of the most important aspects of supporting kids with knee pain, basically. That's what they experience.
Not to forget that communication can be, and the way you prescribe exercise, it's not only words, it's how you manage them during the physical examination, It's how you communicate, how you during the examination, and also when given exercise. Like you said, like you, I can see that you're really strong. This is, you're a strong kid. Like that's, and you can sort of use your hands and your force, and to go into that message, not just your words. So not to forget that it's sort of a, like I think many times prescribing exercise is more of a metaphorical act than the specific effects of the exercises.
I think you're absolutely right. And the thing you mentioned about specific exercise versus a general exercise, because we don't have any evidence to suggest that one specific exercise is better than the other. And some would say, well, that leaves with a lot of uncertainty about what to do. But you could also turn around and say, well, I can actually base it on what is meaningful for the adolescent. Is there one of these exercises that can actually be done side court? Because maybe he's only participating in the warm-up of his football for the next couple of weeks, but he's still there because he wants to be part of the team. Well, then he could do his knee exercise or his hip exercise next to the side court, that you can also talk to the adolescent and the parents about, well, mostly the adolescent, what would be your preference if we had to pick an exercise? Maybe it could be something that mimics one of the movement patterns they do during their sport, and then you would get buy-in there as well.
I think there's a specific challenge with team sports and load management, because I had a girl in the clinic. She was, I think, maybe 13, 14, playing football. And then gradually during the training sessions, she got more pain and she was limping in the end. And then we were discussing what you said. I asked her if she wanted to like cut down on the minutes or just be either in or out, maybe taking her out of like the whole session, like maybe two instead of three sessions. And I agree with you. The best is often to ask them, but I think it's hard. Like, should I accept her limping? That was a question I got. Like, and she was like, no, it's okay, I just limp. And then I was like a physiotherapist, I think that's, then you probably have more pain than you should. And that's, but how do I know? Maybe it's okay.
That's a big question. Sometimes it's very easy just being a researcher. Then you, because the challenge is answering a question like the one you have, because a lot of team sports, they won't allow for you're either in or you're out. And if you're out, wow, that has a detrimental impact on the quality of life for these young individuals. They're suddenly not part of their peer group anymore. They're in risk of not making the first team and only have to go down to second or third team. So how do they do that?
This is a identification, like their how they view themselves compared to their peers. And I for myself, I find sometimes it can be better to just reduce the number of total sessions, because like standing on the side as a adolescent and everyone's looking at you and you have to explain, I have to leave the court. And there's some more symbolic active way of like going away from your peers than just staying away from one whole session. Then you're either in or out, but okay, yeah, I'm not sure. This is, I think this part is hard, especially in team sports.
I think it's incredibly, incredibly hard to do. I don't have any good ideas, but because it's so different also from the parents and the kid that you have to sit and discuss with, that sometimes they have ideas themselves, like what you say, that they only participate two times per week and not three times, or they don't participate in the match during a week plays, or some of them would like to have a period of where we just try and tinker around with like the number of sprints they do, or they only sprint at 80%, or we try to let them not kick too hard or move around on the field in other positions where they don't have to run as much. Because one of the things today is that we start to realize how important it is to be part of a team, that it's not the pain that's always the issue. The issue is if you can't participate at full performance together with your team, that's the issue for them. A bit of pain, hey, they would all be okay with that as long as they could be part of the team. So I think the role for us is to really be creative and finding good ways to keep them being being part of the team one way or the other.
And that's coming back to the pain stories. That's one of the stories that I remember from one of the participants saying that I will not be that girl or boy that leaves the field or holds my team back. So that's the difference between individual sports and team sports as well. Because if you hold your team back, especially in that age, that's they won't feel good about it, and they will more likely have pain than holding their team back.
We had one of the other participants. I can't remember if it was in Pain Stories here or one of the upcoming studies where we had this young kid trying to explain that the way he saw it was that he had sort of like a bank account. And then he knew that he could do things which sort of like brought money into his bank account. And then when he played together with his team, he had to withdraw from his savings. And whenever he got too low in his savings, he got a lot of pain. And for him, like a constant like reflection on, if I go out in the schoolyard and do X, Y, and Z, I'm actually going to take money out of my savings. But then I'll have less money for this afternoon where I have to play together with my team. But maybe I can go home and rest and take a nap. Then I can also insert money into my savings account, because everything was based on him being part of that team. That was his whole savings analogy, which was quite interesting from a 13 or 14 year old boy.
Yeah, it's a great, great analogy. And that's part of like the self-management learning, the challenge that you were mentioning. And he's probably has challenged himself and then learned that I can do this, but I can't do that. And then that's what self-management really is, when they start learning in that way. So maybe we shouldn't be so afraid that they get pain now and then. And when they come back to the clinic and they say, I had pain during this session, and you said, oh, okay, maybe then we have to do something. Because that's also a way of communicating that they're not in shape. They're so injured, they can't have pain.
Exactly. And I have found myself in this a lot of times when they come back and they've had pain. And then we sort of like talk about how, okay, now we need to find a way not to get you into that situation as well. Instead of trying to frame it more positively, okay, so we had a little pain. That's completely okay. It's just a small flare up. But what can we actually learn from this situation? What are you going to do differently next time? Or how can you face this challenge? So we'd use it as just an opportunity to learn something, for them to reflect on what actually happened and what they're going to do the next time. Because patient education to improve self-management is key of what we need to do with these young individuals, because often it's a long-lasting condition.
Yeah, maybe we should start wrapping up, and we can talk a little bit about the prognosis. What can we expect from these kids and their condition? Are they going to get well, or do we see them the next 10, 20 years?
Depends on where you are. I think that the most likely scenario is that a lot of them will have recurrent episodes of knee pain. The difference is that if we do the self-management aspect, the patient education to support self-management, the next time they get a flare-up of knee pain, they know what to do. They're not worried because, hey, it's just a flare-up. Now I know what to do because I've succeeded once. I'm going to succeed it again. But some other individuals will, if they haven't been taught self-management of their knee pain, they will, of course, contact their general practitioner or their physiotherapist and ask, what do I need to do? I've had a new flare-up of my knee pain. But in terms of the prognosis, we've been looking into the long-term prognosis of adolescent patellofemoral pain for some years now. We're just doing the 10-year follow-up of the old cohort that I established during my PhD, actually. And we're just in the midst of it, so I don't want to share too many details, but it appears that roughly one in every three of the kids between 15 and 19 with patellofemoral pain will also have knee pain even 10 years later. So they were between 15 and 19 back then, and now they're between 25 and 29. So it appears to stick with them. So that's one side of it, that prognosis is not super good. And then we have to discuss how to communicate that to the adolescent. But if we turn it around and look at some of the new studies where we are taking a more active self-management approach, there we can actually see that the prognosis is substantially better compared to the older studies where we focused on exercise therapy as sort of the cornerstone of rehabilitation. Because there, I think in the last study we did, we had 86% that was recovered. So we're much better or better after 12 months. And I think it was 55% that actually said, I'm completely free of knee pain after 12 months, which is much, much better compared to the older, more exercise-focused studies we've done. And I'm using that actively because we have some data to suggest that if we just wait it out or offer you a leaflet with some advice, which is not too dissimilar compared to just wait and see, we can see that roughly 40% will be better after 3 months. 40% will be better. But if you take an active approach and you do something, then it will be somewhere around 85% that will actually be better. And if we present these numbers to kids and their parents, they're often more inclined to actually do something themselves because they can see, okay, from 40%, all the way up to 85, and 85, that's almost 90, 90 is almost the same as 100. And then they suddenly also buy into the suggestions that we have. So coming back to your question, is the prognosis good? Well, if we don't do anything, then I don't think there's a super good prognosis, and a lot of kids will continue to have pain, functional limitations, but the newer evidence suggests that we can actually do something, but it's not just exercises. It's also an active approach that teaches them how to manage their knee pain. And then I think we can improve prognosis.
That's really good to finish up on a positive note. you have so many like the stages and ladders and all the visual tools. That's what I'm looking for in the word. All the visual tools. Where can people find these visual tools?
So I haven't like consolidated all the tools we've made for clinical practice, but I'm in the verge of the next couple of weeks setting up like a repository at our university where at least they can just download them. So maybe in the notes, we can share a link to this repository. Maybe when the time this podcast is up and running, then the tools will also be there. But on the upside, now this is a small advertisement for, I'm trying to put together sort of like an e-learning program, completely free of charge, that sort of like includes all the research and other people's research within the field of helping kids with non-traumatic knee pain. So hopefully by the end of this year, there'll be a free e-learning platform with some quite nice content based on all the research we've done that people can just log in and take the course as they go along. We're very keen on knowledge translation and teaching, so this is our idea of trying to get more of our research out into out where it actually matters, which is clinical practice.
Yeah, that sounds really good. Great for clinicians to have this e-learning program. With what I would assume is the best information available from talking to you. Is there anything that we haven't mentioned that you thought we should talk about? Of course, there's it's a huge subject, but something specific?
No, I really like this talk because it was not the focus on what kind of exercise should we do or not. Should we do exercise or don't do exercise, but more qualifying, like, that exercise can have different purposes and we need to be aware of these different purposes. And I like your questions on like communication and the initial diagnosis that it, I think that's where a lot of the gold is for helping these young kids with knee pain. So thanks for the opportunity.
It's been great. And maybe that's the future of PFP research as well, highlighting some of these subjects in more detail.
Excellent.
Yeah. But thank you very much for talking to me on the podcast. I really enjoyed the talk as well.
Likewise.
Hvis du likte denne episoden, del den gjerne i sosiale medier og gi meg en anmeldelse i din podcastspiller. tips til temaer som du ønsker å høre mer om eller andre tilbakemeldinger, kan sendes til kontakt@moenfysioterapi.no.